From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. This week, the American Music Theater Festival premieres the new opera, Tanya, based on the kidnapping of Patty Hearst. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the composer, Anthony Davis, who also wrote the opera X, The Life and Times of Malcolm X. And we have a performance by Tanya's two lead singers. Also, Bill Clinton is preparing for tonight's MTV town meeting, while President Bush is considering doing more TV talk shows. Perot has led this campaign in a new direction. We'll talk about the latest developments in personality politics with Robert Smoole, the author of a book on the subject called Statecraft and Stagecraft. And world music critic Milo Miles profiles Zaire's Papa Wemba. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush and Russian Federation President Boris Yeltsin agreed today to eliminate all intercontinental ballistic missiles with multiple nuclear warheads and to slash their nuclear arsenals to 3,500 missiles each. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Mr. Bush said the agreement to drastically reduce nuclear arms would be carried out in two phases and completed by the year 2003 and possibly even by the year 2000 if the United States can assist Russia in the required destruction of ballistic missile systems.
With this agreement, the nuclear nightmare recedes more and more for ourselves, for our children, and for our grandchildren.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin called the agreement an unparalleled and probably unexpected thing for you and the whole world. Yeltsin said with half the population of Russia living below the poverty level, it was no longer possible to maintain a large nuclear weapons arsenal. The two leaders also agreed to push negotiations to set up a nuclear early warning system. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
President Yeltsin also said today that it's possible that American prisoners of war may still be alive in the former Soviet Union. Yeltsin agreed to cooperate with an investigation to locate Americans who may have been imprisoned in the Soviet Union after the Second World War, the Korean War, Vietnam, and incidents during the Cold War. President Bush said that a team of investigators would be sent to Moscow immediately to look for information on the fate of the prisoners. Yeltsin said a joint U.S.-Russian commission on POW issues has already met with some success. Ross Perot, a likely presidential candidate, has changed his mind about testifying before a Senate panel investigating Americans missing in action in the Vietnam War. Although Perot had originally agreed to testify, he now says the hearing would become a political circus. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
2 weeks before he was scheduled to testify before the special committee, Perot has bowed out, saying it would do a grave injustice to the MIAs and their families to have a hearing any time before the election. The likely independent presidential candidate who once sought to take charge of the MIA investigation now insists that both Democrats and Republicans on the committee would be tempted to go after him as a political target. However, Perot may also be concerned that members are likely to ask him about assertions by Vietnamese officials that he had discussed becoming a business agent for the Hanoi government to attract U.S. investment. Allegations have also been raised by former officials that Perot disclosed without authorization the Reagan administration's strategy for resolving the MIA cases. The Senate panel has the power to subpoena Perot. Committee Chairman John Kerry says Perot's knowledge of the issue is essential to the committee, which must finish its work by the end of this year. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 25 points to close at 3,329.49. Declines led advances by a slight margin. This is NPR. In South Africa today, thousands of black workers stayed home to commemorate the anniversary of the 1976 Soweto uprising. African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela called for the boycott as part of a campaign to force the white minority government to speed up the transition to a multiracial democracy. Mandela has accused the government of allowing the current state of violence to continue so that it can maintain its power. Israel's two contenders for prime minister faced each other in an election debate today. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Exactly 1 week before Israel's national election, voters had their first and only chance to see a primetime televised debate between Likud leader Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir and opposition labor leader Yitzhak Rabin. The debate seemed directed to the tens of thousands of floating voters, those Israelis who, according to the polls, voted Likud in the last election but are considering a different party this time. Shamir promised them he would never withdraw from the Israeli-occupied territories but would continue to pursue the peace process. Rabin said he had three principles: no to 2 million Palestinian citizens of Israel, no to a Palestinian state, and no to an Israeli withdrawal to the 1967 borders. Rabin also accused Shamir of creating a crisis in U.S.-Israeli relations by refusing to freeze Jewish settlements. Shamir said there was no crisis, and he was confident that Israel would receive $10 billion in loan guarantees from the United States. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger is categorically denying federal charges listed in an indictment against him announced today by the Iran-Contra special prosecutor. Weinberger is accused of lying to Congress and withholding notes that detailed his knowledge of the scheme to sell arms to Iran and channel illegal aid to the Contra guerrillas in Nicaragua. He's the most senior Reagan official to be charged in the Iran-Contra scandal. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're about to hear a preview of a new opera that will have its world premiere tomorrow night at the American Music Theater Festival in Philadelphia. The opera is Tanya. The story is loosely based on the kidnapping of Patty Hearst by the radical cult group the Symbionese Liberation Army. One of my guests is the composer, Anthony Davis, who also composed the opera X, The Life and Times of Malcolm X, which was performed by the New York City Opera in 1986. Davis first became known as a jazz pianist and composer. 10 years ago, jazz critic Francis Davis described him as being in the forefront of a new generation of musicians who can claim the hard-won advances of the jazz avant-garde of the 60s and 70s as their starting point, and who can borrow from European concert music without jeopardizing their places in the African-American continuum. With us to perform excerpts from Tanya are Cynthia Aronson, who plays Patty Hearst, and Mark Doss, who plays Sinkyu, the leader of the SLA. Alan Johnson is at the piano. We actually recorded our session yesterday on a day off from previews. I asked Anthony Davis if he sees Tanya as a companion piece to his opera about Malcolm X, with Sinkyu as the false prophet, a false militant leading a false revolution.
Yeah, well, there are all kinds of falsehoods in this piece. I don't think there's, it's a chronicle of falsehoods all the way through it. And I think that, that's part of it. I mean, I think naturally a composer is attracted to that. I mean, with Elijah Muhammad and X, was another compelling character to write for, because the idea of the person who really sweeps people away and sweeps them into his world, into what he's thinking, and that's very powerful and very, very powerful thing to represent on stage and in music. And so I thought about that. And then also with this story, what's really interesting is if you look at the whole issue of brainwashing, how a person is brainwashed in the sense that she's drilled into becoming Tanya, but then she's drilled into being Patty again, too. So I felt that balance, I think, is really important in the piece.
When you portray both worlds as being equally shallow.
Yes, I think so. And the idea that in a sense, we're buying into whatever doctrine, whatever someone else imposes on us.
Actually, this might be a good point to introduce one of the arias that Patty sings, speaking of shallowness, because the whole idea is like, who will play me in the movie of the book of my life?
Right. This is an aria. Michael John Lacuse is the librettist, and it's called Who Will Play Me in the Movie of the Book of My Life?
And we have Cynthia Aronson with us, who stars as Patty and Tanya in the opera Tanya. And accompanying her at the piano is Alan Johnson. Me in the movie of the book of my life.
wanna look Hollywood? Do I wanna look tan? Who will play me? Play me in the movie of the book of my life?
Cynthia, are you used to singing librettos as colloquial as this one?
No, I've never sung a libretto as colloquial as this one. Even small words like wannabe instead of want to be or...
Oh, that's right, because you're supposed to be really pronunciating.
Pronouncing.
Pronouncing the T at the end of want. And
right,
and,
it's actually written wannabe.
So have you had to sing differently because of how colloquial the libretto is?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I work really hard on the diction and on really trying to make the words clear. And I work on that normally. I like to sing in English. I do a lot of contemporary music.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm used to singing English. And I don't think I really have to change any. Just in my thoughts, I have to change something.
You know, we should mention, in speaking of how colloquial the libretto is, our listeners haven't heard half of it.
Really?
Yeah, it gets very colloquial. First of all, you know, since you're dealing with revolutionaries and the SLA, there's, you know, lines about death to the fascist parasite, which feeds on the people, and lines about offing the bourgeois pigs and blowing them away. And there's language that, of course, we can't repeat on the air because it is obscene. Anthony, I'm curious about finding a musical style or musical styles that match the kind of political rhetoric that you wanted to use in here and the kind of mood that you wanted.
Well, I find that this was one of the most easiest text I've ever confronted for setting to music because it sings. It really does. I mean, I think the colloquial language disguises the fact that it's really rhythmically set beautifully, and the rhythm of the language is really beautiful. Michael John is also a composer, so he's really...
He's the librettist.
Yes, and so he really understands how words sound. And in this case, when I was setting the words, I felt very free to use the let the speech language sound, you know, to start with the speech language, the speech rhythms, and to look at the speech rhythms and how they really helped me create melodic ideas and melodic and melodies. And so I felt that it was really, in a way, really easy to deal with. And also using repetition, repeating lines and repeating words, I think it really was fun and for me a real a joy to set to music.
I think some people will find it really incongruous that an opera should be using words like mother bleeper in it. And do you expect to get the kind of reaction from audiences like language like this doesn't belong in an opera, or is that?
Well, I never thought opera was highbrow anyway. It's always had the tradition of being, of all the classical art forms, it's the one that always used to communicate to me with popular culture. I mean, if you look at Mozart operas, I mean, Mozart's operas were considered obscene too, Marriage of Figaro or certainly Magic Flute. So I think and the idea of using vernacular language, Mozart, when he did his first opera in German, that was pretty shocking to people too. But I think that the idea of really creating an opera that's about American culture and about our language and American English, you know, not some Italianate English or any other English, but our English, and something about our culture that reflects our culture. I think that's something that we need to really be thinking about. And I think that the language in this opera is very successful because it really captures everyday speech, yet it is poetic and lyrical. And it captures this way that people spoke, particularly in the 70s, you know, that
slogans.
People involved with Berkeley radicals might speak. And that's I think that's important, too. And it's not to me, it's not that contrived patois of the Porgy and Bess or any of that stuff. This is, and the language really sounds real. And really, I think it really has a rings true, and I think that musically, that means that, you know, I'm halfway there in a sense, because if the language rings true, then musically, what I can do, I think, can be real too.
Well, I think musically, you know, you're talking about using real language and like our language, you know, like the language of colloquial American. You're doing that musically too. You know, you're using jazz and classical forms within the opera.
Definitely, and I think you know that's something that the libretto really created for me too. But the idea of using and also, I think what helped me was that my experience as an improviser, because when I think of how I'm setting a line to music, I think of, in a way, I think about the way Miles Davis might play or Billie Holiday might sing or something, because rhythmically I can play with the language and the music so that the language sounds, so that the words sound. And I think that's really important part of how I conceive the music. And I think the interaction of the words with the music, I think, works really well.
Cynthia, you spend probably about half of the opera blindfolded and handcuffed in your slip, lying on the floor, which is not the best position, I'd imagine, from which to sing an aria, and probably also not the most comfortable position to be facing the audience. Can you talk a little bit about what it's like to be in that position on stage?
Well, it was really interesting because it really gave me an idea. I mean, it's totally nothing like the experience that Patty Hearst went through. But it didn't make her sing. But I really feel helpless. Uh-huh. I'm really literally at the mercy. I mean, my hair falls in my mouth. It gets in my mouth, and I can't get it out. And the blindfold maybe slips, and I can't, you know, deal with anything. And I'm really at the mercy of everybody else on stage. And it's a very helpless feeling.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the new opera, Tanya, based on the story of Patty Hearst. We're also hearing excerpts performed in our studio. With me is the composer of the opera, Anthony Davis, Cynthia Aronson, who plays Patty Hearst, and Mark Doss, who plays Cinque. Alan Johnson is at the piano. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. We're speaking with people from the new opera, Tanya, which has its opening Wednesday night. It's being produced by the American Music Theater Festival in Philadelphia. I want to introduce Mark Doss, who plays Cinque, the head of the SLA. Welcome, Mark. And Anthony, we're going to hear a duet between Mark and Cynthia. Let me ask you to set the context for the duet we're going to hear.
Okay, well, this is after the kidnapping, and Patty's blindfolded, and she's remembering. And she's saying, "I remember the Cadillac we had, my mom's." And she's still remembering things from the Hearst world, from her past. And Cinque comes in and starts to sing to her, and she says, "Patty, you're not Patty anymore. No, no, no." Then as the aria proceeds, he sings this aria really about rage, about her coming to the rage. And at the end of the aria, it begins the rape scene, the actual rape of Patty, which happens at the end of the scene.
Anymore. Oh, I'm not. No, who am I? Do you know who I am?
Should I?
You've been looking for me for a long time.
I have.
You lost me and forgot me.
I did.
At your birth,
I remember that Buick we had, my mom's.
Smoke in your jumbo jet. I'm the bomb at your Super Bowl. I'm the outlaw. I'm the other law. I'm the anger you hunted down, who now hunts you. I'm the anger you captured, you sold and abused. I'm the scream at your birth and the chaos you tried to deny. I'm the shadow in your closet, under your pillow, in your dark and darkest dreams. I'm the bomb at your Super Bowl. I'm your love and your fear.
Wonderful. That's great. And that's Mark Doss and Cynthia Aronson singing an aria from the new opera, Tanya. And as Anthony Davis mentioned before you sang that aria, this is followed by the rape scene. How is that choreographed? Do you want to talk about working that out on stage?
Very delicately, I think. we've done some reworking on it, and I think we've come up with something that's very much in good taste. And I think the symbolism that's involved is more prominent, actually, than what is actually happening on the stage. But one is left with the impression that a rape has actually taken place. And as I said, it's done in good taste.
Do you want to add anything to that, Cynthia?
I just follow him. He does it all. I'm just lying there with my hands tied behind my back. It's up to Mark.
Let me ask you what I asked Cynthia before. Are you used to singing a score with a libretto as colloquial as the one in Tanya?
Well, actually, I was in X that
oh, sure,
Anthony
okay.
had done
yeah,
so
yeah.
before. And a few other pieces. I've done a piece called Blake, I think, that was done by Leslie Adams in Cleveland. And a lot of things in workshops, sort of at Lyric Opera Chicago. We have a composer in residence there, so I did a couple of works there.
Are there colorblind roles in opera now, or basically the only roles in opera the roles that were written black for an African American singer like yourself?
Well,
you know what I mean by colorblind casting. Like, you know, in a sitcom episode, if there's a doctor. Usually, if the doctor's not written African American, it's cast as a white person.
Right.
But in some colorblind casting, if it says doctor, it's like, well, who's ever good gets the part, and it mm-hmm. could be, you know, African American actor, a white actor. But it seems like in opera, it's fairly set. racially, unless that's really opening up.
Sometimes. I mean, the miracles of makeup are quite far-reaching. Grand opera is something that deals with distance, usually. The makeup can be, I mean, I've worn a false nose, and people say afterwards, I didn't know that was you. I mean, color changes are not totally out of line because someone does Aida, and you don't expect them not to put on darker makeup. At the same time, there are different concepts that a director can have to make a work more contemporary and then bring in different, you know, cultural, ethnic, whatever, diversity into a production.
I think you wanted to add something to
that.
Yeah,
opera's always been more open, I think, than a lot of the traditional television or movies or theater about casting. I mean, because you always see, I mean, at the Met, for example, you always see, you can see sisters who are black and Asian and white or whatever. I mean, that's been happening for a long time.
It seems to have been harder for men, though.
It's harder for men, I think. I mean, they've been open for the Kathy Battles and Price and other people like that. But I think with male roles, I think it's been slower to open up. And actually, particularly with tenors, actually even more so than basses or baritones. But I think that's beginning to change. But But traditionally, opera has been the idea of this sort of this remove from reality and portraying everything as realistically. Since when someone's singing, actually, is in a sense singing, is not realistic in a certain way. I think it allows for this kind of casting to happen.
No, I saw a production of Tanya Sunday night. It was a preview. The official opening night is yet to happen. I'd like to know what goes through your minds as you're preparing for an opening night, which must be one of the most exciting and terrifying moments for any performer or composer. Anthony, what about you? You're like in the back of the audience or waiting in the hall or something right on opening night. You've done your work already. It's kind of out of your hands at that point.
Well, that's the feeling. I mean, the feeling is, I mean, I feel I'm in great hands. So that's first of all. I mean, it's a feeling of confidence in the people I've worked with, and I do have confidence in them. And you know, we've worked hard up to this point, and I just want them to enjoy it. And I try to let everything. I'm going to leave the score at home. You know, I'm not going to bring it. It's just that it's letting the piece go and let it happen, and not feel that. Because and I think for a composer, the hardest thing is to realize that you're not in control anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You can't stop and say, oops, wait, that was too slow, or that was too fast, or that was too soft, or whatever. You know, you just have to let it go. I mean, and it's out into the world, and it's something else. It's not, it becomes its own animal in a way. It's something that is beyond who you are. And that's exciting too. I mean, that's fun.
Well, I love the opera, and I wish you all great success with it.
Thank you.
Best of luck. And I want to thank everybody for being here with us, the composer Anthony Davis, Cynthia Aronson, who plays Tanya, Mark Das, who plays Sinkyu, and with us at the piano today was Alan Johnson. Thanks to all of you for performing and for talking with us. Alan, can you play something from the overture to play us out? I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. H. Ross Perot began his undeclared campaign with an appearance on the Larry King Live Show. Bill Clinton has sat in with Arsenio's band and tonight appears on an MTV town meeting. President Bush says he's considering appearances on talk shows.
This is not politics as usual. Coming up, a talk with writer Robert Smool, author of Statecraft and Stagecraft, American Political Life in the Age of Personality. And world music critic Milo Miles profiles one of Zaire's foremost performers, Papa Wemba. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Officials of the U.S. and Russia have agreed to cut their long-range nuclear stockpiles by the year 2003. Currently, the two nations have a combined stockpile of around 21,000 nuclear warheads. They have now agreed to cut this number to at least 7,000. The plan is aimed at cutting long-range missiles, bombers, and submarines on both sides far below cuts called for under the START Treaty. The START Treaty still has to be ratified by the U.S. Senate. Yesterday, Secretary of State James Baker said that there were four or five questions that needed last-minute work. Family members of two German hostages held in Lebanon have been flown to Crete in hopes the two men will soon be released. They had been expected to be turned over to authorities today, but so far this has not occurred. Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
Together with a doctor, Heinrich Strubig's daughter and the parents of Thomas Kempner flew from Bonn to Crete on a German Air Force plane. There has still been no confirmation of news agency reports in Syria and Lebanon. The two Germans were handed over last night to Syrian security forces. Relief workers Strubig and Kempner were kidnapped 3 years ago in Lebanon. The kidnappers were members of the powerful Hamadi clan, who tried to force the Bonn government to hand over two Hamadi brothers serving German jail terms on terrorist charges. A German foreign ministry official who met in Beirut today with the Lebanese president says he is not flying back to Germany without the German hostages. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
UN officials will resume talks with Baghdad this week over whether or not to allow Iraq to sell a limited amount of oil. A UN spokesman has confirmed that a meeting will be held Friday in Vienna. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The spokesman said Assistant Secretary General John Domenico Pico will appear on behalf of the UN at the talks. Iraq is expected to be represented by its UN delegate, Abdul Amir al-Ambari. The two sides have been struggling for months to come up with a plan under which Iraq can sell oil. Baghdad has been under a near-total trade embargo since shortly after its invasion of Kuwait. The Security Council approved a plan last year that would have allowed Iraq to sell $1.6 billion worth of oil under strict UN supervision, but Baghdad refused to go along with the plan, saying the tight controls represented a violation of its sovereignty. The recent talks between the UN and Iraq have been shrouded in secrecy. Asked today whether a tentative agreement had been reached between the two sides, the UN spokesman declined to comment. At the UN, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 25 points to close at 3,329.49 on volume of 178 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of 5-4. This is NPR News. Former Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger has been indicted on charges that he concealed what he knew about secret arms sales to Iran and aid to the Contras. He was charged by a federal grand jury in Washington with two counts each of perjury and false statements and one obstruction count. Weinberger is the highest-ranking government official to be charged in the Iran-Contra scandal. He has denied any wrongdoing and calls the indictment unjust. In France, farmers have stepped up their protest against cuts in farm subsidies. They want nations of the European Community to rescind a decision to reform EC policy. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
For a sixth straight day, farmers use their tractors to barricade country roads in southwest France. Traffic going into some towns was completely paralyzed as a result. In other areas, the farmers let doctors and ambulances pass, but they blocked all other cars. The protest is being organized by a militant group which opposes the EC reform. Although it's highly unlikely they'll get their demands, they say they'll continue demonstrating. Next week, they plan to bring their protest to Paris, and using their tractors, they say they'll block all traffic coming into the city. it's not clear what the government would do if they carry out their plans. The Minister of Agriculture says he's hopeful that he can convince them that the subsidy cuts will not affect their income. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
In Washington, the government said today that the nation's trade deficit was down to $5.3 billion in the first 3 months of this year. This compares to a deficit of close to $7.25 billion in the last 3 months of last year. This year's first quarter figures were aided by a drop in oil prices and increased tourist travel to the United States, along with improved earnings by U.S. banks trading overseas. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Let's take a look at what the newspapers reported today about the presidential campaign. President Bush is considering following his rivals onto TV talk shows. Bill Clinton has an MTV town meeting tonight. The New York Times Arts and Leisure section has an article comparing the talk show styles of Clinton and Ross Perot. Just some of the latest developments in media campaigning in the wake of Perot's success launching his campaign on The Larry King Show. My guest Robert Smoole is the author of a book about American politics in the age of personality called Statecraft and Stagecraft. He directs the program on ethics and media at the University of Notre Dame. He says the Perot phenomenon is an example of personality politics at work. Here's what he means by personality politics.
By that I mean the individual political figure who, in a self-selected way, comes to the fore and presents himself or herself to the public and says, I want to run for, and then fill in the blank, president, governor, senator, whatever. The individual over the institution. One could say the self-made person in love with his or her creator. That's one dimension to it. The other dimension, and one that I talk about in the book and think is very important, is the personality within this new culture. And I would call it a political culture, but I would also say that it's a media or celebrity-oriented culture. And you see that someone like Perot, to use him as an example, begins a campaign on a talk show and then cultivates the following by numerous other appearances on television. And let's face it, he came to us already known because of the popular culture, because of things like that television movie about the rescue of his workers over in Iran. So the personality and the link to the popular culture is just another dimension of personality politics.
Do you think that there are any dangers implicit in personality politics?
Oh, I think there are a number of dangers, and I guess I would point to one being the cult of the personality. The idea that someone would emerge and become so powerful that our institutions could not accommodate that power, or indeed that the institution themselves would be violated. So that I see that. I also see that... let's face it, when we talk about media culture, we're talking about stars, and the brilliance of stars can blind us, and we don't see people in the whole complete way that's necessary for the informed judgment that's required.
A lot of Americans have demonstrated their disgust with politics and politicians. What do you trace that back to?
I think that there are a number of reasons. The one that I would point to would be the disconnection, the feeling that campaigns in America today operate without people. And by that I mean that the volunteer, the person who is working on behalf of a candidate, that person... really doesn't have much to do. Why? Because so much of politics today revolves around television, revolves around the advertising that the professionals are able to put on our screen. So that, I'll give you an illustration. few weeks ago, we had the primary here in Indiana, and I was down in Indianapolis and wanted to pick up information about the various candidates, and in the case of the Democratic and the case of the Republican parties, had to go into large buildings and up several floors in order to get anything. And I said, could I have some information about so-and-so? And one of the workers says, I'm sorry, we don't print up brochures anymore. We devote all of our money to television. Now, here I was just trying to get some basic biographical and policy-related information, and that wasn't available to me. I think that the people felt as though they had lost the control and the connection, so that with Ross Perot, and again I would say that this is one of the strengths of the campaign, you have him doing the television and fanning the flames of interest, but then you have something like 300,000 volunteers who are out there with buttons, with bumper stickers, with the petitions to get him on the ballot, and you see a resurgent of citizen activity in politics that we have not seen in several years. Why? Because the playing field changed, and it changed so that television became the main and only event.
In your book about personality politics, you trace personality politics back to the electoral reforms of the late 1960s. Would you make that connection for us?
Sure. 1968 is a very important year, and I suspect many of our listeners will remember that that was the year that saw the emergence of Gene McCarthy and Bobby Kennedy, but ultimately the candidacy of Hubert Humphrey on the Democratic side, also the candidacy of Richard Nixon on the Republican side. Coming out of the convention, the Democratic convention in Chicago in 1968, there was a sense that the people were out of the system. Hubert Humphrey never competed in a primary during that year. He was given the nomination because he was Lyndon Johnson's vice president. And after that, Gene McCarthy did a book called The Year of the People, and the people spoke, and the people said, we want a new system that allows for more open participation. And that more open participation in the presidential selection process led to the great number of primaries that we now see. It also led to the phenomenon of a person saying, I think I will run for president of the United States, this personality, rather than any sort of institutional standing at work there. So that in 1968, I believe there were 15 primaries in this country. This year there were somewhere, it was around 36 to 38 primaries. The opening up of this process opened it up so that, yes, it is more democratic, but it also feeds on this personality politics.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Smool, and he writes about personality politics. He's the author of the book Statecraft and Stagecraft, American Political Life in the Age of Personality. He's also the acting chairperson and an associate professor in the Department of American Studies at the University of Notre Dame. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Talking about personality politics and the current election campaign with Robert Smool. One of the things that Americans seem to be disenchanted about with American politics and politicians is that you need a whole lot of money. You basically need to be very rich to run a campaign, even, you know, with a political party behind you. And Perot, in a way, is just like the ultimate example of that. You know, he's a multi-billionaire. He's going to fund part of his campaign out of his own pocket. He's offering to make some changes for the country out of his own pocket.
So do you see him as heading in a direction that would lead us even closer to the idea that to be a politician in America, you need to be very, very rich?
That's interesting, and I think that that his wealth cuts two ways. It cuts in the direction of, look at this man, he's a billionaire. But I would say that he has rather cleverly portrayed himself as saying that he is the servant of the people, as saying that he's only doing it because the people want him to do it. Go back to the interview with Larry King. If people put me on the ballot in 50 states, I will do it. He is putting the burden on the people and then saying, okay, then I will spend my own money in order to help those people. He is a salesman, and he has found a way of selling himself quite effectively with the American public.
Do you think that perhaps one of the reasons why so many people are behind Perot with his billions is that they feel that his billions will make him immune to being corrupted by money or by special interests?
Oh, I think so. I think that I would say that Ross Perot is different from, say, a Nelson Rockefeller, to use an example. People would say, my gosh, he bought the governor's chair in New York. But they looked at that differently. They said he used his family money in order to do it. With Perot, it's his own money, and he has earned it. And by using his own money, he then is able to sort of inoculate us to the sense of him doing something that is wrong in order for him to be elected. And I think it's a way of saying, look, the special interests are too much involved in the process, and these PACs have too much of a say. I will not accept money from them, and as a result of that, not be beholden to those particular interests.
Do you think that the visits of candidates to the talk shows now is going to mean the end of the League of Women Voters style debates?
No. I think that the debates will take place, and I think that it is probably very important that they do take place. Why? Because it brings together the candidates, and they can deal with the same issues at the same time so that people can see them together. No, I see it as a supplement, as a way for these particular candidates to get their messages across at this particular time.
One last question. I know that you are one of the many people who has been disillusioned with the direction campaigning and politics had been heading in. But do you think what we're seeing now in the presidential campaign is reform in a productive direction, or do you think it's getting us further away from where we should be heading?
I'm not sure that that I would use the word reform in talking about 1992. By that I mean that I see much of it as being improvisational. I see Perot emerging and then people reacting to that, and his use of talk shows allows for the others to get into the act. To the extent that we see longer formats and more discussion of issues, I think that is a plus. But until we get to the hard facts of changing the system so that it works in a more responsive and responsible way, I guess I don't see much change in our politics.
Robert Smule, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Robert Smule directs the program on ethics and media at the University of Notre Dame. His latest book is Statecraft and Stagecraft, American Political Life in the Age of Personality. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Terry. We'll have the latest on former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger and the Iran-Contra investigation today. We'll also be hearing about the status of relief efforts in Los Angeles since the riots, and we'll be talking with the owner of a shopping center, a mini mall there, we've been checking in with. So far, 6 weeks after the riots, he has had no assistance whatever and thinks that at least half of his 17 tenants won't be able to return to business because they've had no aid, whatever. We'll also be hearing about refugees from the fighting in what used to be Yugoslavia.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Papa Wemba is an innovative African pop performer with a career and a following as extensive as many rock and roll veterans from the 1970s. But world music commentator Milo Miles says few of Wemba's rock peers can match his vitality today.
He's been a singer and bandleader for 22 years. He was born in Zaire, lives in Paris, and has management in Japan. No wonder he has trouble arranging for a tour of the U.S. At any rate, Shungu Wembado, known as Papa Wemba, stands tall on the map of African pop as the performer who did as much as anyone to change the amplified rumbas of his grand forebears into high-tech soukous and make that style the most popular music in Africa for another generation. The word that comes to mind when you think of Wemba is hard. Hard electric guitar sounds, hard, even harsh vocal tone, and hard-driving arrangements of dance rhythms. Yet I believe he's the original velvet hand in the iron glove. Not many of his lyrics have been translated, but the few I've seen reveal a thoughtful, even tender soul. Another clue is that his favorite African-American vocalist is Otis Redding, that big, brawling voice attached to the vulnerable heart. Redding wanted to put passion up front and all over you in a song, and the same applies to Wemba. You don't need to know the language to sense that. One measure of Papa Wemba's savvy is that he always seems to have it both ways. He was a scruffy rebel who became a fashion plate. He was a relentless progressive in music who became a champion of the roots pop movement in Zaire. In 1970, Wemba was a founder of the band Zyko Langa Langa, which was called the Rolling Stones of Zaire. Wemba's showy wardrobe and flair for stage drama also suggests David Bowie and Rod Stewart. Zyko Langa Langa made Zairean rumba leaner, more insistent, by eliminating the chugging horn charts and by emphasizing metallic guitar tones and long, feverish improvisations. Of course, vintage Zyko Langa Langa doesn't sound too ferocious to us in the land of speed metal and gangster rappers.
Mama alobi na ngai na luka yo yeba na tamboli moto moselu yangu ma ekipa moto te tokutani na ma elika na pesi aloba kompeto yambani oh la mule na biso ebani se sera chouchouna na komi kopanga lenge tolingani yeba yeba
Wemba left Zyko Langa Langa in 1974 and a couple years later formed his band Viva La Musica, which continues to this day with various personnel. Given that Wemba associates designer clothes with a certain independence and pride, it was inevitable that he should wind up in the center of Francophone fashion by the end of the 1970s. He fit in well with the cosmopolitan Afro-Paris scene of the last decade, and a testament to his staying power is that while he's clearly an old pro, he retains the aura of an up-and-comer. Unavoidably, however, Wemba's albums have grown a shade routine over the years. He makes a mighty effort to stretch himself on his first American release, Les Voyageurs, and most cuts deliver a surprise, like a tart cluster of voices, percolating electronic subrhythms, or some peppery soukous guitar. Overall, Les Voyageurs sounds a bit slight and synthesizer crazy to me, but because it's the most readily available of Wemba's records, you should give it a shot.
Makase bongo awa diose bongo zape atinda ma abongo mokambi monene yesika ya mosala mikilina mikili biso bena kokatisa bibale pe na bangomba esenga pete kwa tamala moko na kolama lita wisi monene nzamba sala wana mokili.
Other even better choices, if you can find them, include the albums La Esclave and Ekumani. And, well, there are at least three albums called just Papa Wemba. The one with the gray cover on the Stearns Africa label and the one with the brown cover on the Discs Esperance label are the most potent. Just remember, if it says Papa Wemba on it, it's hard to go too far wrong.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Boston. Papa Wemba's new album, Le Voyageur, is on the Earthbeat Warner Brothers label. Fresh Air's senior producer this week is Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Ajiva Blytus, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross, and here's more from Papa Wemba.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet film director Joan Micklin Silver. Back in the 1970s, she was one of the very few women directing. Her films include Hester Street, Between the Lines, and Crossing Delancey. Her new HBO movie, A Private Matter, is about abortion. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.